This week in Retronauts, the ones are the loneliest number. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode, 347, baby. That's right, this one is locked in time. I am Jeremy Parrish, your chronologist here at Retronauts. And, you know, 2020 has been a, shall we say, shitty year, and we're leaving it behind, hopefully for a better year, although, you know, life doesn't really work according to calendars. So we'll see. But now that we are at the end of the year, one thing that is consistent and constant is that we are recording an episode, kind of getting ready for the new year, by looking back 10, 20, 30, 40 years in history to talk about the events of video gaming. Actually, we're looking back 50, 40, and 30 years. Bob has bogarted the look back at 20 and 10 years, so we will not be discussing those years here. Instead, as we move into the year 2021, we will be talking about 1971, 1981, and 1991 in video gaming. And I've adopted a new format for this this year's discussion because the last few episodes, the last few times we've done this, it's gotten a little unruly. So I'm going to try to rule it back up again. And here to help keep things tidy, hopefully, it's a Retronauts East episode, the first we've done in like half a year. It's been a long time. Woo! So, yeah. Guys, everyone's probably forgotten who you are because it's been so long since we have done one of these Retronauts East episodes that people probably don't even remember. Like, it's been several years since last month, and even longer, like decades since last year. So, yes, who was that forgetful person who just spoke up?
That was me. I have no idea who I am anymore. I haven't had to, like, you know, leave the house and use my name all summer.
Okay, so. You wrote it down on your hand in a marker. What does it say there?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm Ben Elgin, right.
All right. Ben, good to have you back on the show. Who else is there with a very similar but not exactly the same name?
That's me, Ben Edwards.
All right.
Reporting to you live from a hellscape of 2020.
That's where we all are, live, but fortunately alive. As opposed to the alternative. And finally.
Oh, hi. It's me. It's me, Chris. Chris Sims.
Way to go. I'm here. All right. Okay. So we all remember who we are. That's very exciting. Now let's try to see if we can remember history, video games. So once again, this is going into, you know, prefacing the year 2021, looking back in time, as is the Retronauts tradition, looking back decades, to discuss what video games were like at key points in video game history. There was no video game history in 1961, so we will be beginning with 1971, where there was barely any video game history, and probably Binge is the best person to, like, the person best suited to talk about this.
I agree.
So why don't you fill us in on what things were like back in 71, back when you were, you know, in high school or whatever it was?
Yeah, I was negative 10 years old at the time.
Fantastic. So share us your prehistory memories there.
Yeah, so 71 was the genesis of the commercial video game industry. It saw the first ever commercial video game product ever sold, which was Nutting's Computer Space arcade game, developed by Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney. And I don't know how deep you want me to get into that history because I wrote a really long article about it back.
We talked about, you know, kind of the history of computer space and Atari and, of course, Nutting Associates, which Chris loves, his favorite mm-hmm. video game company name ever. We talked about that a bit last time, so I don't think you have to get too deeply into it. But 1971 was when those efforts finally came to fruition, and we finally did have a commercial video game that failed abysmally, actually.
I don't know. See, the conclusion I reached in my article is that it was surprisingly successful for the time. And it did only sell about 1,000 units. But the kind of units they sold back then in arcade games were around 2,000 was like a really successful game in electromechanical games. And so compared to Pong, which sold 19,000 units, which, like, insanely blockbuster success, for that time. I mean, like, their games like Gauntlet later, you know, only sold like 7,000 or 8,000 units anyway. So Pong was such a monumental success that it made Computer Space look really like a failure. So I think, relatively speaking, Computer Space was a success.
Okay. I guess that's fair. You know, kind of adjusting for expectations. Like, Sega's very first console, the SG-1000, sold like 1 million units or something, and it came out the same day as Nintendo's Family Computer, which sold, you know, 50 million or something worldwide. But Sega still considered the SG-1000 a great success because it did much better than they expected. So I guess, you know, you kind of calibrate according to what you hope for and see what comes out.
The fun thing about history is you can change the criteria at any time.
Right. It's the winners rewriting everything.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben.
The thing to keep in mind here, like, we're talking about this in the context of video games, but as Ben was just saying, the things it was competing with was like electromechanical devices, and even Computer Space itself didn't actually have a computer in it, right? It was just, it was futzing with the ray tube on the screen to create sprites directly through like circuits. Like, none of this stuff had programmed computers in it. That was kind of before that. And so this was sort of a whole other level of mechanical things that people were building to put in game spaces back then.
It's fascinating. It was a piece of wizardry, Computer Space. I have some bullet points I put together here. I could run through them real quick.
You might as well. We're all here on the line.
So Computer Space was published by Noting Associates in 1971. We already said it had sold 1,000 units. It had a one-piece fiberglass body, which was, I can't remember who sculpted it. Maybe Nolan sculpted it in clay, and then Ted took it to this guy who made boat hulls and fiberglass hot tubs and things like that.
Cool looking swirly thing. Didn't it end up in a movie?
It's sparkly. Yeah, it was in Westworld, I believe.
And Soylent Green.
Okay.
It's in Soylent Green, I think.
Okay.
With Charlton Heston. And there's a funny story about that.
It is a beautiful machine if you've ever seen it in person. I've you know, those show up occasionally at conventions, and it's got that kind of like, you know, like bowling balls that, you know, they made back in the 80s and 70s. They just had that kind of embedded sparkly quality, that like that fiberglass quality. Like, it's just beautiful, and it's seamless and curved, like nothing else that, you know, you would expect to see in an arcade.
I think it's mica dust that they just embed in a resin covering over the fiberglass.
Makes sense.
Anyway, so the Soylent Green thing is funny, is that Ted Dabney told me this story. See, I interviewed these guys for the article. So Ted Dabney's now deceased, unfortunately, but he was a really cool guy. And he told me he went to see Soylent Green when it came out in 73, and he was amazed that Computer Space was in the film. And so he went and told Nolan Bushnell that he'd seen the movie, but he asked him like, "Hey, did you see the movie?" And Nolan said, "Yeah, but it wasn't a very good film." That's all I said. And he said, "Didn't you see Computer Space in it?" And Bushnell said, "No, I came in late." That's what I wrote.
I see.
Anyway, so, but, you know, it's possible he never actually saw the film, but just was making it up. Anyway.
What are you saying about Nolan Bushnell, sir?
Nothing. Nothing at all. It was inspired by Space War, the mainframe, you know, game that originated on the PDP-1.
And I guess we would be talking about that next year, right? That was 62?
Yeah, 1962, yeah.
All right.
And Bushnell saw it and wanted to put a coin slot on it. He thought, man, this would make a great arcade game, because he had worked at an arcade midway at his summer job while he was in college. And once he moved to out west to work at Ampex after he graduated, a Data General Nova mini computer came out, which was the cheapest mini computer at the time. I think it was like $10,000 or something. I can't remember, which was a lot of money back then. And he thought, this is my chance. I could program Space War clone on this and put it in an arcade, maybe power two cabinets with one computer. But then they did some calculations and said, oh, it's not powerful enough. And then they just sort of let it sit for a while. And then at some point, Ted Dabney told me about Nolan's epiphany he had. And this is a direct quote Dabney told me. He said, "Nolan came to me one time and he said, on a TV set, when you turn the vertical hold on the TV, the picture will go up. And if you turn it the other way, the picture goes down. Why does it do that?" And he said, I explained it to him. It was the difference between the sync and the picture timing. And he said, "Could we do that with some control?" I said, yeah, we probably can, but we'd have to do it digitally because analog would not be linear. And so the whole point is that he just had an idea, like, let's just directly control the video signal on the screen. You know, we don't need a computer. Let's just mess with the timing and the, you know, the sync and everything. And so Ted Dabney went off and designed a board that could do that, that could move a spot around on the screen with switches. And then he handed it off to Nolan, and Nolan just went off and went to nutting and said, hey, I want to do this game and everything, and made this deal and started designing the logic of computer space. And so the actual game itself was sort of like Asteroids later in terms, or like Space War, where you control a ship. You had one button to shoot, two buttons to turn the ship left and right, and you had the momentum of space. So if you go forward, you drift for a while until you, unless you retro rocket, you know, you turn around and fire the other way, your rockets. And then there were UFOs that would zigzag on the screen, and you had to shoot those, and they would shoot at you every once in a while. And the outline of the UFOs and the ship were all individual dots. And it was amazing how the ship could rotate. And it's really smooth and incredible game. And it made its debut in Chicago, Illinois on October 15th, 1971 at the Music Operators of America show, trade show. And that's all I wrote down. I mean, the rest, you got to look at my article on technologizer.com. It's called Computer Space and the Dawn of the Arcade Video Game.
So that is a pretty succinct summary of, basically the first commercial video game ever. Amazing.
Yep.
There's another one on here that I had never really heard of before, but you made a note, I think, Benj.
The Galaxy game?
No, PDP 10 Baseball. I assume you put that there, Benj.
I did not. I don't know. I think you did.
Oh, maybe I did, and it's been, you know, several years since I put these notes together last month that I don't remember.
Yeah. The PDP 10 Baseball, I have never... You know, I know Don Daglow, who designed it, maybe mentioned it once or twice in an interview with somebody, but we have no real record of what it was like or pictures of it or anything. So it's very vague.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, the PDP 10 was a mainframe computer. I think it's the same computer that that Space War was originally created on, or was that a PDP 1?
It was a PDP 1
okay.
originally, but it's part of the same sort of series. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, yeah, clearly it's also Yeah, Digital Equipment Corporation, using the same technology, but a later generation, blah, blah, blah. In any case, that's not a commercial game, but it was one of those sort of formative early efforts to create a game that, you know, would eventually kind of trickle out into the mainstream. But I think a more notable and actually the final thing we want to talk about in 1971, there's an instance of a game being created. And you can argue over whether it's a video game or not, because it didn't have a video screen, but it did eventually make its way into the mainstream, and it is a game that you can still go to the store and purchase 50 years later. And that is the Oregon Trail. And have you guys ever played the original version of Oregon Trail?
Which one? That's a teletype version?
Yes, yeah. The original version, the one we're talking about here in 1971.
No, but I have like some printout pictures of it.
Okay.
So, like, surely someone has emulated this.
Oh, yeah, probably. I mean, they preserved the code, they recreated the code of it once it was deleted. But basically, the story is that some educators, some high school teachers, I believe, made use of local computing time on a shared system and had a teletype interface for it in their classroom. And they put together a simulation of pioneers making the journey from Missouri or Mississippi all the way to Oregon. Yeah. And it was put together by a trio of teachers, Don Rauch, Bill Heineman, and Paul Dillenberger. And basically it was just a thing they put together. They programmed, and it was kind of like magic. They gave it to their, like, they let their kids in their class use it, And they would, you know, say, give simple commands to the computer, type those in, and the computer would send back, you know, a printout on paper that outlaid what happened as a result of their efforts. And it was very simplistic. They could go hunting. They had to worry about, you know, their stocks of food. They had to worry about crossing a river at the ford or whatever. But it was still a very innovative, very revolutionary way to teach. And this game, you know, like I said, was originally created for a single classroom on a teletype system. And at the end of the semester, all that data was purged, but the creators, the programmers, went back and recreated what they had done and preserved it and continued to iterate on it. And eventually from that, they founded the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium, or MEC, which we've done an episode on quite a while back. And they began to license out the Oregon Trail, not even just license, but to share it, to spread it across other computers, to use as education simulations, and then they began to sell the game commercially to bring in money for MEC. And yeah, it's just a very groundbreaking, innovative approach to using computers very early on to make learning more interactive and more exciting for students. It's hard to imagine kids these days getting excited about inputting a command and watching a typewriter slowly output what happened. But, you know, in 71, it was a simpler time. We were simpler people. We didn't have supercomputers in our pockets.
That's true. Yeah, I saw Rauch's postmortem at GDC 2017, and I got to meet him, and I shook his hand. I was really proud.
Nice.
Well, we played Oregon Trail and the Apple II, which came out in 1982, that version. And
I thought it was 85 for the...
Really?
I have 82
written down. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, it was 81, 82. Okay. I know this because now I get to plug myself. Last year, I put together an audiobook for Audible on the history. I wrote and recorded a history of video gaming, and there's a whole section on the Oregon Trail. So I pulled that up and I'm looking at it here. But yeah, the Apple II version did come out in the early 80s, and I believe that was distributed for free to schools, but they did begin to create graphically upgraded versions, more elaborate versions, sell those. I believe it was purchased by like the Learning Company or something.
Yeah,
it was the graphical version that came out in 85. There was the text Apple II version was earlier. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, without the graphical version, we'd never have pepperoni and cheese.
Yeah. Before we skip out of 71, we have to mention Galaxy Game briefly because somebody will be mad.
All right. Who is somebody?
In 1971, Bill Pitts and Hugh Tuck bought a $14,000 DEC PDP-1112 mini computer. I'm reading this. And a $3,000 vector display with money gathered from their family and friends. They created a version of Space War, installed it in the Treseder Memorial Union at Stanford. And they sold games 10 cents a game or a quarter for three games. This was in mid-1971. And the funny thing is, Nolan Bushnell knew about this. And he heard about it and he went to go see him and talk to him. They both visited each other. In fact, Bill Pitts and Hugh Tuck were essential witnesses of Nolan actually working on computer space in the lab, which is neat. But Bushnell said they were kind of funny guys that were technical but not real focused on world domination. So he didn't find him a threat, and it never really went past Stanford. But that was something that happened in 71.
Yeah, world domination was much more Bushnell's kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that is 1971. 50 years ago, video games were a thing. It's very exciting. They weren't much of a thing, but they were a thing. And in the following years, the next 3 or 4 years, the medium would explode, and there would be so many video games. It leads us to where we are now, where everything is bad. But things were still good back in 1981. The next year we're going to talk about in 81, you know, 80, 81 to me is really when video games became a thing, like not just a little amusement, not just kind of like a quirky object you saw sometimes at the laundromat or whatever, but like a pervasive cultural force. And that has a lot to do with the specific games that were released in 1981. And I'm going to go down a very thoughtfully organized alphabetical list of what I have isolated as the major games from 1981. This is not all inclusive because we do not have that much time, but we're gonna go down this list really fast. And then we're going to go back and everyone's going to talk about a couple of things that they find personally significant. And that way we're allowed to kind of provide an overview here of what 1981 was like and 1991 after that, and go into depth on a few things, but also kind of keep it on track and organized so we don't get to, you know, like an hour and a half into the podcast and we're still in 1981. I'm like, oh my God, we're going to have to do this another one. It took us so long to get this episode together to find a way for everyone's schedules to line up here in pandemic times. I just can't count on that again. So we're going to make it happen, guys. Brace yourselves. Here we go. All right, 1981. Major games include Astro Smash for Intellivision, Castle Wolfenstein for Apple II, Defender for arcades, Donkey Kong, the Dungeons & Dragons computer fantasy game, which is a standalone handheld in the Game & Watch vein, Frogger, Galaga, both for arcades, Gorf, which was Atari 2600. Did that have an arcade predecessor? It was just a 2600 game, right?
It was an arcade game.
Oh, okay.
For sure.
Never saw that one. I've played golf, but not Gorf. There was Kaboom for Atari 2600, Lock and Chase for arcades, Quix. That's right. That's what the katakana says. Quix. Kuwikasu.
Quid tested, mother approved.
That's right. That is... yes. that was an arcade game. Scramble.
We'll come back and talk about it.
Scramble, another arcade game. Skyskipper, another arcade game. Soft Porn Adventure, which was not in arcades. Maybe the arcades in the back of like a, you know, an adult novelty shop with the, you know, the beaded curtain and everything. I don't know. Stargate and Tempest, both for arcades. Tombstone City, 21st Century for TI. That's the TI 99 4A, folks. Turbo for arcades. Ultima for personal computers, Vanguard for arcades, Wizardry, also for personal computers, and Zork 2 for personal computers. All right, so that is an overview of the games of the year. Oh, wait, there's also hardware and other things that happened. This is also conveniently alphabetized. There's Analog Magazine. Was that the very first video games magazine? Oh, wait, there's like three magazines here. There's also Computer and Video Games and Electronic Games, all jockeying for... the right to be first. Analog was the one that had programs in the back, right? Where you were like, wow, I'm going to type in my own programs, and you mistype one character and it doesn't work. And you're like, what did I just waste my hour on?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there was the BBC Micro computer, the IBM personal computer, the PC 8801 personal computer, the TI 99 4A personal computer, the VIC 20, and the ZX 81. All right. So 1981, that's it. Now we're going to go back through this list of seminal, monumental, momentous events. I noticed, Chris, you didn't mark anything down here.
Chris was but a wee babe.
So, Chris, explain yourself. You have not signed up to discuss anything on 1981.
Yeah, I don't know anything about any of these.
What? Not even...
I feel like...
Defender? Frogger? Kaboom? Like, these are...
I played Defender a couple times. And I understand, like, the legacy of Defender... same with Frogger, but like the ones that I would be most familiar with were unfortunately snapped up by Ben Jedwards.
I see.
Who want to talk about Donkey Kong? That's the only one that I have any real connection to.
Well, you could talk about
you can both talk about it, but you should talk a little bit about Defender So let's do that. Let's go alphabetically here. Chris, you are being put on the spot to talk about Defender. So defend your opinion about Defender or your lack thereof.
Well, I feel like my opinion about Defender requires no defense because my opinion is pretty good, actually. it's really interesting to me that Defender and Galaga came out in the same year. I mean, like, this was kind of the beginning of a big boom period, as you said, Jeremy, so it's not that surprising. But, like, those are kind of the two games that really defined the space shooter forever. I played Defender on the Atari 5200, which we had when I was a kid, that we got at a yard sale for, I think, $12. And it was really the only game out of everything that we had for it. And we ended up having like 10 games that came with it. It was the only one that I think held up, because this would have been like 1990 that I was playing this. and Defender, which, you know, is you're a spaceship, side-scrolling, you shoot stuff. You know Defender. If you're listening to Retronauts, you know Defender.
You got to rescue the people.
My thought on Defender for 5200 is that that game must have been really frustrating, because 5200 had this, you know, the infamous controller that was analog and did not automatically recenter. Whereas Defender is designed in the arcades, it did not have a control stick. You had digital, you know, like a left right button, and you could accelerate and, you know, rise and stuff. But, or actually, no, it had up and down buttons, and then it had accelerate. So it was like a very complex kind of control scheme to keep your head around, much less intuitive than a control stick, but they were still finalizing, like, standardizing controls at that point, control schemes. So it just seems like, you know, having that kind of muddy control interface for Defender would be really challenging, but you still feel it held up pretty well.
Yes, it was quite bad. The Atari 5200, just in general.
It was a mistake.
But yeah, like, of everything, it was the most fun to play, because even though it had the frustrating controls, and even though it was, again, well past its sell-by date, it's still, you get it, right? Like, its beauty is in the simplicity and how well it's done, like, in most forms. So yeah, like, the problem is, I never really gravitated towards the Defender legacy. Like, I was never super into the why do we call them shmups and not just say shoot 'em ups? We don't need that much.
That's a British thing. We don't have to do that.
Yeah,
like, just call them shooters.
The bullet hex. I never really gravitated to those because I'm just not good at them. I enjoyed playing Defender, it didn't hook me, and I do wonder if I would have been exposed to, like, the arcade version or, like, a different version of it, if I would have come away as a bigger fan. I still have fond memories.
I was never even good at Defender. Although I was playing it, I think, Macintosh port much later, obviously. So on a keyboard, which is also maybe not ideal, but my memories are of it is that it's just really hectic. There's a lot going on at once, and I was never any good at it.
Yeah, it's interesting, Chris, that you describe Defender as simple, because I feel like when you sit Defender and Galaga next to one another, you really get a kind of a great sort of case in point example of the difference between sort of American Western game design at the time and Japanese game design at the time, because Galaga is very simple, but there's so much that emerges from its very simple sort of graspable systems. Whereas Defender, you have a bunch of buttons, you have a bunch of things flying around on the screen. You've got a mini map on a scrolling screen. You have different kinds of aliens. You have, like, you know, a smart bomb, you have the ability to warp, you have to manage attacking enemies while also preventing them from absorbing or killing humans, and you have to avoid killing humans, and it's really fast paced, and a game lasts like 60 seconds if you're, you know, even decently capable of playing the game. It was a game designed to be really hard, really complex for the time, and very, very challenging to keep your quarters flowing. My former boss, Jazz Rignall, used to be like a world record holder for this game. You know, the kind of person who could play it for a day straight or something, like hours on
but
end.
But at heart, it is a game about flying around shooting things.
It is, but there's so much you have to deal with and learn. I mean, if you want to, you know, simplify it, you can say Minecraft is a game about hitting walls, but, you know, there's a lot more to it.
I wouldn't know.
By the way, Defender, I think, was the first, or supposedly the first arcade game or video game that had an off-screen world going on that you could scroll through. And, you know, that's the mini-map was a big innovation in that game.
Yep. Yeah, all the enemies and humans are still moving and existing off the screen on the whole torus that you're on.
Yeah, there's probably some example of like a, you know, a Plato game or something that had like a world happening off screen. But yeah, in terms of commercial releases, like mainstream hits, Defender was definitely the first to say, hey, there's more to life than what you see on the screen. And, you know, at the same time, you had the game Donkey Kong come out, which was four individual screens that kind of typified the concept of like what you see is what you get. This is your entire world. But before we talk about Donkey Kong, I would like to contrast Defender to Galaga. Ben, you had kind of put your name down next to Galaga. So tell us about it. What's so great about that game?
That was just one of the ones that stood out to me. Like, it always struck me as the game that took, you know, the basic template that was started way back by Space Invaders and just made something a lot more enjoyable out of it. Not that Space Invaders isn't fun, but it's kind of one note, you know, you're shooting at the things, they're coming down. That's basically all that happens. Although you've got the UFOs too. And then Galaga takes that and just, you know, you've got lots more interesting enemy patterns. And then there's the whole mechanic where it can capture your ship and you can get it back to, so your power up system is rescuing your own previous lives, which is just a pretty cool concept.
Yeah, there's a real risk reward to that because, you know, to strengthen yourself, you have to give up a life. And that was, you know, you only had three lives. So you're diminishing your playtime in order to get a power up. And once you do get the power up, you are in much greater risk of taking damage and losing that extra life because you have such a wide profile to your docked fighters.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it takes the basic template and just does a lot with it. And then it's also got these the intermission levels where you're just trying to shoot as much as you can before they go off the screen, but they've got all kinds of patterns and just the variety of patterns that the enemy ships fly in seemed like, I don't know, just a lot more complexity than you saw in most games of that era in terms of enemy behaviors.
Yeah, and the first, you know, 10 stages or so seem kind of repetitive after a while. You're like, okay, I'm getting the hang of this. And then you keep hitting these milestones where all of a sudden new things are introduced. Like, enemies start to attack in different patterns. They start to weave around more. You start to see, like, ships mutate into other ships. It gets pretty wild, you know, the further you can make it. So it's a really good, challenging game. It's pretty tough to get past, like, the 10th stage or so. But people who are really into Galaga can get really far, and it's a great score-chasing game. But it's much, much less frantic than Defender and much less complex. You have a control stick and you have a fire button, and that's it. The control stick lets you go left and right. So compared to Defender, you know, there's a lot less to manage. There's no smart bomb. There's no mutants or anything like that, aside from the ships that morph into one another. It's just a much more elegant game.
It's the roles as, you know, Space Invaders and Galaxian, just with more going on to interact with.
Yes. So that was very much kind of the ultimate iteration of Japan's invader boom, kind of the peak of taking that Space Invaders concept that you mentioned and turning it into something with a lot of depth and a lot of just sort of immediacy. It's really great. A good, fast-paced, entertaining game.
And one of the most successful arcade games of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you can still buy it in many forms. Numbskull put together a really great quarter scale cabinet for it last year that is very nicely made, very authentic to the arcade cabinet. It looks great, plays really well. So, yeah, a timeless classic. But also, that same year, we have a timeless classic in the form of Donkey Kong, which represents a totally new school of Japanese game design emerging. Donkey Kong was not the first game of its type, but it definitely was the point, the inflection point at which this kind of element, like this concept of platforms and ladders and stuff that was sort of bubbling to the surface really took form. And Benj, you've got your name next to this one, so I'll let you and Chris hash it out.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, yeah, Donkey Kong was a great game. It began as a conversion of Radar Scope, which was an unsuccessful space shooter game. But your name is quoted in Wikipedia, Jeremy, talking about Radar Scope. Do you want to briefly talk about that or anything?
I'm sure I said everything that I have to say on Wikipedia. Okay. No, Radar Scope was another one of those Invader-style games. And it was, you know, a decent success in Japan. It like added kind of a three-dimensional perspective to the action, if I'm remembering right. But it was, you know, still just basically Space Invaders Galaxian. And yeah. They said, oh, this is going to be our big game. Nintendo said, this is going to be our big game in the US. It's going to be a huge hit. Let's manufacture 2,000 of them and put them in the US. And American arcade retailers or arcade distributors were like, nah, we're not really interested in this. And then the games took months to come over from Japan via a very slow boat. You know, they were being shipped by freight. So by the time they arrived, no one wanted them. And Nintendo was stuck with this warehouse full of cabinets that they couldn't sell. And basically, that was the end of Minoru Arakawa, Inoue's president. That was the end of his life. His father-in-law, Hiroshi Yamauchi, the indomitable president of Nintendo Corporation Limited in Japan, was like, yeah, you gotta make this work out. So they put together a conversion for it, and a plucky young artist named Shigeru Miyamoto said, what if we made this a Popeye game? And they said, that's a mm-hmm. great idea. And then King's Features Limited said, no, you can't make this Popeye game. So they said, what if we made this a King Kong game? And didn't call it King Kong. And Nintendo was like, you know what? Go for it. So Miyamoto sat down with, Gunpei Yokoi worked on it. And I believe Hirokazu Tanaka did the audio for it. And they planned out this game and worked with some programmers at an electronics company called Ikegami Sushinki. And they put together mm-hmm. this arcade game that was a huge hit. In both in Japan and the US and in Europe, everyone loved it. And why not? Because it was, wait a minute, you're supposed to be talking about this, not me. Why do people love Donkey Kong?
You just work through all the bullet points of the notes I put together.
You told me like what's up with Radar Scope, and I told you what's up with Radar Scope.
Yeah, but you also told me what's up with Donkey Kong, but that's good because you said it way better than I would have. I was going to talk about Popeye briefly and Ikegami Tsushinki, all those things. The cool thing about Donkey Kong is that it made a really human protagonist front and center, I think, almost for the first time, like a notable character instead of just like a little stick man on the screen. You know, Mario had some detail to him and he was called Jumpman at first, right? I mean,
He didn't really formally have a name.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, they didn't actually technically call him Jumpman. That wasn't like an official designation. He was just like the guy,
yeah.
But then they quickly named him Mario, yeah.
So, first appearance of Mario, by the way.
Yeah, I have two quick thoughts. One, mm-hmm. I think it's weird that when they wanted to like file the serial numbers off of King Kong, they kept the name Kong, and not just like King something else.
King Donkey.
Yeah, King Donkey. what an odd world it would be if it was the KD crew.
Yeah, well, you know, copyright and trademark things were a bit looser 40 years ago, and in Japan things were way looser, not in the sense of like where you have you create something interesting and then 3 days later there's like a Chinese factory stamping them out, but it was just like the idea of property rights and copyright is just handled differently in Japan. And you know, especially when you're dealing with foreign properties, like they probably didn't even know necessarily who to talk to about King Kong, or they didn't really care to talk to them. In any case, King Kong was in the public domain by that point, so it didn't matter. But that would take lawsuits to determine. But yeah, it was just a case of people playing kind of fast and loose with trademarks and licenses and that sort of thing. And you saw a lot of that throughout the 80s in video games, and then corporations took over the world and that kind of cool fun stuff went away forever.
Yeah. The second thing is Donkey Kong is one of the most important video games of all time. Is it the most important?
I do not like that definitive article, sir. I avoid it altogether.
Well, that's take a stand, Jeremy.
It's Nintendo's most important video game, probably.
Although they love Super Mario Brothers more.
Yeah, but they would have never had any of that without Donkey Kong starting that whole train rolling, you know, especially with Mario.
I have this book over on the shelf called The Anatomy of Super Mario Brothers, and it starts with Donkey Kong, actually.
Oh, yeah?
I don't know who decided that.
That's pretty wild.
It's weird to think that this game is the foundation of so much else. You know, like we don't get to Pokemon without this game. You know, we don't get to Luigi's Mansion 3 in a very direct way without this game.
But we don't get to Donkey Kong without Space Invaders. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
The platformer and the mascot game would have arisen at some point, but this is what was there.
Yeah, but imagine a world where all we had was Sonic.
There would have been no Sonic without Mario, so it's all just like dominoes toppling.
It's all connected.
It's
all connected, man.
And see, like, not only how foundational it is, but how different it is from other games, and how different it is from what would come later, but also like the similarities, like jumping being such a thing. Like, you don't even think about it because it's the most natural thing in the world for video games that progressed from like Donkey Kong to Super Mario Brothers to platformers to on through to, I don't know, Hollow Knight or whatever. But like the importance of jumping and the importance of mobility being something that was established so early on here, not to mention like, you know, genre tropes of like kind of this hero on which you could project yourself, but also who had a little bit of personality of his own. Like there's design there. And then, you know, having the object be the lady you have to save. Like there's so much that like is rooted in this that is such a big step from a Space Invaders, from a Pac-Man, from all that, you know, like it's really interesting. Again, I don't know if the most important of all time is a good descriptor, but I do think it's an interesting one for Donkey Kong.
You could say Chris Sims thinks this is the most important video game of all time. I'd agree with that statement.
I actually don't think that.
It definitely set a lot of direction. Like, you know, it's not necessarily a foregone conclusion that, you know, jump is one of the primary verbs of this kind of game. You know, you can have a game where you progress over obstacles by like climbing over them. But
yeah. And that was exactly the case with this game's predecessor, Space Panic. Was that what it was called? Yeah. By Universal, where you were like a dude climbing ladders and digging holes so that enemies could fall into. It was like a proto Load Runner, like the mix, the midpoint between, that's right, Hey Onkyo Alien, set us out of the klaxons, and Load Runner. And that was, you know, a 2D platformer, very similar in kind of its overall viewpoint to Donkey Kong, but without the jump verb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So jumping was important.
Mario invented jumping.
Chris is obviously onto something. It was so incredibly influential, the fluidity of movement, the jumping and all that. And I mean, we wouldn't have Metroidvanias without Donkey Kong.
That's true. That's why I covered Donkey Kong in Metroidvania Works.
Is Donkey Kong a Metroidvania? That is what I would like to discuss.
100%
is
not. So we're going to move along from Donkey Kong now, because the conversation has degenerated to a few other little, definitely lesser games from 1981, but still worth talking about. There's Quix, or Kix if you prefer. You're wrong, but it's Quix. So Ben, you want to talk a little bit about that?
I'm going to debate you on this Quix thing. So apparently, as seen in the North American promotional flyer, it was pronounced Kix, and this was actually developed by Taito America. Mm-hmm. So I think they take precedence.
I have to say, you can't trust marketers. You have to go by what's written on the box, and if you look at the Japanese box copy, the title is Quix. And Taito was a Japanese company. They didn't know what their American people were doing, but their American people were definitely wrong, because they were not in Japan. Anyway, so tell us about what is Kix or Quix?
Kix or Quix. It's this weird little puzzle game. And it's just one of the reasons I picked it is it's just kind of unique. You know, it's not a falling stuff puzzle, it's not a pushing blocks puzzle. You have this square field, and there's this line that is sort of rotating and bouncing around inside the field. And that line is the enemy. If you touch it, you die.
It is the quicks.
Yeah. And you are this little dot that goes around the edge. And what you try to do is venture into the middle of the field without getting hit by the line, and then make your way back to the edge, and you enclose an area with a trail behind you, and then you've claimed that area. And so you try to keep doing this while avoiding getting hit by the line. And then sometimes there's other enemies, like little sparks that will also follow you around the lines. And then at some point you've enclosed a certain amount of the area, you know, it depends which version of the game you're playing, and you win the level. And then it goes on and it gets harder. And so it's a pretty simple concept, but this like spinning line is this weird concept, conceptual enemy character, that looks really cool. You know, it just looks like a trippy screensaver kind of, and then yeah, it's just kind of addictive. You keep trying to find different ways to close off areas. You can do clever things like get two protrusions from the edge close together and then, you know, zip through and close them off. And sometimes you can even trap the enemy in a tiny space and you get bonus points. Mm-hmm. It was originally on some vector systems, wasn't it? Because that would make sense. But then it's ported basically everywhere, and had all kinds of spinoffs, including weird like soft porn spinoffs. So the like Gal's Panic genre comes from this, because someone realized that as you're closing off space, you could reveal something behind, like a picture. And oh, hey, it can be a picture of, you know, titillating women back there. And then we can sell more because people will buy soft porn, anything.
Yep. Yeah, so Quicks to me, or Kicks, is kind of an alternate take on the basic concept of Pac-Man. Like I've come to realize Pac-Man is less about navigating a maze and more about dominating space, like taking possession of space. And you look at games like Crush Roller, City Connection, Lock and Chase, all these games that kind of were sort of Pac-Man-esque in a way, where you're like moving around a space and trying to change the state of the maze or the corridors or the passages. Even Q-Bert, where you're jumping around trying to flip colors of cubes. All of these games are about kind of taking over space. Quicks is about, you know, drawing like simple lines and partitioning off space in large chunks, as big a chunk as you can possibly manage without getting, you know, taking damage. It's a different take on the concept, but definitely very addictive, pretty simple to understand. You know, it was a big game for Game Boy, a big release. Nintendo actually developed it in-house. And they stuck Mario in the endings. So
I had that version.
Yeah, it was very popular. But yes, it also became like the basis of an entire pornographic games industry, which was kind of given a solicitous okay by Taito under the table, like not formally, but they were okay with it. I think they kind of were involved in some of the early ones, like Gal's Panic, which weren't quite as super pornographic as the later ones.
Panic was actually Kaneko.
Okay.
Was the publisher on. But yeah, I think they did have an agreement with Taito.
Speaking of pornographic.
Yes, it's an amazing segue, Binge. Go for it.
Yeah, so 1981, the year I was born, also happened to be the first time anyone published an adult video game that I know of. Computer text adventure game, I guess, not a video game. And it's called Soft Porn Adventure by Sierra. They were called Online Systems at the time. But the funny thing about Soft Porn Adventure, I'll just describe this. It's developed by Chuck Benton, and it has a simple object verb parser, and your goal is basically to sleep with three women through the game. And it's all text-based. You type it in. So it was on computers like, you know, the Atari 800, the Apple II, later the IBM PC, things like that. And when I was a kid, we had a copy of this for our Atari 800. It was like a bootleg copy that my dad got at work. And for some reason, he's like, okay, kids, just go play with this. You know, it was in this big pile of games, you know. And my brother could play it. But it was so insanely tame. honestly, by today's standards. And we didn't understand most of what was going on in it anyway, because like you have to buy a rubber at one point. It's like I had no idea what a rubber was, you know.
It's like a Super Bowl.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
it was happy
yeah.
fun ball.
Your lubed, ribbed rubber ball. Yeah. So
okay.
You have to describe it. I mean, that's the way that the game describes it. And so you play through your I can't remember what your guy is. You go through a bar, you go through like a casino or something, and you're sort of around a hotel, and it's just basically Leisure Suit Larry. If you've ever played that, this is like a text.
Surely this has to be inspiration for that.
Yeah. So the funny thing about that is that when my brother and I also played Leisure Suit Larry when we were kids for some reason. This is great, great parenting, I know, but
it was the era before hover, helicopter parenting.
Yeah, before hover parenting. And we had a bootleg copy of that from one of my brother's friends because he's 5 years older than me. So, we played that and we're like, holy crap, this is soft porn adventure. Exactly. And turns out it is. What's the guy named my brain? I got COVID brain. What's the name? The famous designer who designed Leisure Suit Larry. What's his name?
Al Lowe.
Yeah, I've talked to him. Sorry, Al. I've emailed him many times. Al Lowe went to Ken Williams and said, well, can we remake Soft Porn Adventure as a graphical game? And they said yes. And so Leisure Suit Larry is basically like a note for note remake of Soft Porn Adventure with graphics.
Okay. And so way more inspiration. It's really a graphical port out, basically.
Yeah. It's incredible. If you play Soft Porn Adventure and then you go see it, it's like the same story and everything. And the kind of like, as far as like lewdness and stuff, I mean, the kind of thing you type is like screw hooker. That's the kind of like sex involved. And at one point, if you're not wearing a rubber when you screw the hooker, it says you have atomic clap, and that's all it says. It doesn't describe like what you do or anything like that.
Wait, now I'm really curious what like 6-year-old you thought atomic clap was.
God, I have no idea.
I mean, this was the Cold War, so it was probably something you had to duck under your desk to avoid.
Yeah. I think, you know, my brother was older than me, so he may have understood some of like what a rubber was and stuff and tried to describe it to me, but it didn't feel too naughty. Like it was just such a weird, ridiculous game. Like I've just loaded it up on my Atari 800 behind me. And here's the description. This is the first scene. It says, I'm in a sleazy bar. Behind the bar sits a bartender. A sign hanging over him says beer $100, whiskey $100. The place isn't furnished too well. A curtain hangs on one wall. Next to the curtain is a button. A fan whirls slowly overhead, moving the stagnant air around. What shall I do?
That's a very expensive beer.
Yeah, it's really weird. And it's also notable because on the cover of the box art of the game is a Roberta Williams, the famous game designer of King's Quest and other Sierra games, is in a hot tub nude with several women. You know, you can't see anything because she's underwater, and there's a butler in his clothes standing there. So it's just an interesting piece of trivia. And they said that it sold around 50,000 copies, which was insanely huge at the time for a game like this. And Lane Nooney wrote a cool article about this on The Atlantic, The Odd History of the First Erotic Computer Game. At the time, I talked to her. Some of her conclusions about how like salacious it was, I don't necessarily agree with, because like at the time when I played it as a kid, it didn't seem like that crazy, but I was also a kid and I didn't know anything, but it's still a cool article about the history of it. So there you go. That's soft porn.
All right. Yeah, kind of a weird little side note, but interesting. So I guess the rest is me, huh?
Well, I would put Tempest if you hadn't, so
okay.
I can talk about that.
Then I'm going to let you jump in a little bit and talk about Tempest, a game published by Atari, designed by Dave Thurer, and made for Vector Systems. Go for it.
Yeah, Tempest is another one that's just a cool twist on the space shooter, so it sort of flips things around. I mean, probably almost everyone has seen Tempest at this point, but the setup is, so it's this vector graphics, you're kind of at the top of a well, so like a polygonal well, think a big like octagon receding into the distance or something, and your ship is on the top of it, and you can rotate around the outside, and then the enemies are working their way up from the bottom towards you, along the various corners of this well. So it's sort of, you know, taking a flat shooter like Space Invaders and sort of warping it into this 3D extreme perspective. And then it does interesting things like, you know, having the enemies jump between the various lines. And I don't know, it seems like I describe it like it seems really simple, but then it gets very hectic in just managing this space. And then a lot of my experience with it is actually the later Tempest 2000, which is one of Jeff Mintner's remakes, is just basically trying to be the trippiest thing it can be, and is basically the best thing to play in a dorm lounge at like 3 a.m., regardless of what substances you may or may not be on. You don't really need any because it provides the trippiness for you. And that was just a fantastic time. So what were you going to say about Tempest, Jeremy?
Just that. No, Tempest is interesting because it was inspired by a nightmare, supposedly. Dave Thurer, the developer, was kind of inspired by a dream he had of these things crawling out of a well. So that's kind of the concept here, is that you are moving along the near perimeter, the near end of a space well, and there are things emerging from the opposite end. They're very tiny, but because it's vector based, they all kind of read clearly, and they all have different behaviors. Like there are things that basically create spikes. They're like sparks that move up, and they create a spike that you have to be careful of, because once you clear a stage, then you move forward to the next stage by passing through the well. And if you encounter a spike, it remains as a passive hazard. There are other enemies that kind of move erratically as they emerge from the well, growing larger. And when they hit the edge of the well, they split in two and become these things like bow ties flipping around the edge of the, you know, the perimeter of the well. And you have to avoid them. So you're like shooting these things, trying to kind of manage, you know, which enemies you're taking aim at and what is a more like, which threat is a greater priority to deal with. It's a very fast-paced, energetic game. It uses a spinner to control, so you don't have to worry about like which button is moving me right. You know, when I'm in this part of the sphere or the circle, like it's very intuitive that if you're going to spin the spinner clockwise, you'll rotate that way on screen. And then The further you go, the more the shape of the levels changes. I think you can choose any one of 9 or 10 stages at the outset. And they start, you know, like with a simple circle, but then they become like a cross. And then later ones are like just a one-sided stair step or a letter V. So it's not a fully connected circle around the edge. So, like the further you start into the game, the more the point bonus you get for starting that far in. But the more difficult it is, the more likely your quarter is to vanish within 30 seconds. So it's just a really well-designed game, very addictive and intuitive. And yeah, Jeff Minter, really huge fan of it, has created many different versions of it, sometimes with llamas. He's kind of a strange guy, but he knows how to make him a Tempest. And Tempest, I think 2000 was the only game worth playing on Jaguar, supposedly.
Yeah,
other than Doom and Wolfenstein, pretty much.
Right, but you could play those on many other systems.
The strikes you mentioned, actually. This is like one of the very few games where beating the level can kill you.
Yes.
Like the transition from one level to the next is itself a hazard.
Yeah. And you can shoot down the spikes. Like if you blast them, they'll shorten. But when you're moving forward through the maze, you actually can't fire fast enough to avoid being impaled on a spike if it's more than a certain length out. So you really have to be careful. Anyway, really cool game, very simple to pick up, very easy and intuitive to play. It's got that kind of cool reverse color vector style, but very challenging. One that I played a lot as a kid. The one other game I want to mention this episode for 1981 is Wizardry, which was, I've done an entire episode on it as an interview with one of the co-creators, Robert Woodhead, who actually lives here in North Carolina. But, you know, a formative RPG inspired by early RPGs seen on the Plato computer system, which was not a public or commercial computer system. It was like an academic system that he had access to, but really kind of the definitive computer role-playing experience, that and Ultima both, were just really huge. And Wizardry actually ended up being bigger in Japan for whatever reason. Like, the Japanese developers who would go on to create RPGs played a lot of Wizardry and really loved it. And so the Wizardry series, even though it's no longer in the hands of its original creators, is still a thing over there. It's still being developed. There are Wizardry-like games being made. It's just kind of a thing. It's a whole thing.
Its DNA is in, like, everything RPG that comes out of Japan, basically. You can trace some part of it back to Wizardry, it seems like.
Yeah, it was kind of innovative. Well, it was innovative for the time in giving you a party of characters to control as opposed to a single character to control. And it was basically trying to replicate the dynamic of a tabletop RPG where you had like six people sitting around playing, but instead you were all six people at once, and you had to deal with different classes, with, you know, the way enemies work, learn different spells. The armor system is basically, you know, THACO. Like, you have armor class as opposed to hit points or defense points. So, yeah, it's very, very formative and helped directly inspire games like Dragon Quest. So, kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I have to imagine there's a ton of it in things today like Etrian Odyssey.
Yep.
And speaking of big deals, what about the IBM PC, huh?
Yeah, so moving over to the hardware section, and wow, even though I organized this, it may still be a two-part episode because I'm looking at 1991 and saying, there's no way we're going to get through all of this by the time Chris and I have to bounce out. So
I can make this brief.
No, it's okay. Like, I don't want to truncate 1991. If we go back and revisit this episode, I don't think anyone's going to complain if we talk about how great the games of 1991 were, because there's so many games that people have nostalgia for in 91. So take your time. Tell us about the IBM PC.
Okay, well, I was going to read something I wrote about the IBM PC just succinctly for, I don't know, PC Mag at one point. You know, it was IBM's entry into the personal computer space, you know, after making many mainframes and other sort of small computers that were not personal, not the price of a personal computer. And IBM intended its PC originally to compete with everything from upper end of the home market, where the Apple II was ruling at the time, to the small business PC realm, which is like expensive personal computers. And to that end, it allowed maximum flexibility. Its base model contained only 6K of RAM, 16K of RAM, sorry, 16K, which is barely anything, and no disk drives, but people could run BASIC from ROM. It had BASIC built in and saved to a cassette drive. It actually had a cassette port, which many people don't remember. And maxed out, though, you could use 640K of RAM, two double-sided double-density disk drives with 360K storage each. That's kilobytes. And color CGA graphics, which is like four colors at a time out of a palette of, I don't know, 16, I guess. That configuration, though, would cost as much as a new car. It was like if you adjust it today, it's probably like $11,000. The price is unadjusted for the base model, $1,565, the low end, to $4,500 maxed out in 1981. So, but it became the forefather of all the x86 PCs today, which we still use. And up until recently, even this same architecture and, you know, descendants of it powered Macs. You know, they still, the x86 Macs, because of the chips in them.
Yep, they're about to go away, though.
Yep. But that's it'll be the end of an era. And also, you know, the PlayStation 4 and the Xbox One and the all these x86 things, they all gain their power from the chips that came from PCs, the PC clones.
Right. Though, you know, IBM didn't really have, I don't know, how involved was IBM with the development of the 8086 architecture? That was, I mean, it was Intel, but
yeah.
How deeply were they embedded in the process? Like, I know the PowerPC consortium was Apple, IBM, and Motorola. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were all kind of you know, heavily involved, like the computer manufacturers were heavily involved in the road mapping and, you know, giving feedback to the chip manufacturer. But I don't know how much that was the case with the IBM PC originally.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. Originally, I mean, the 8086 was developed before, you know, that came out in 79. That was before the IBM PC came out. And so I think they didn't have much say into Intel's creation of the x86 architecture. By the time the 286 came around, they may have had some input or something, you know, because the PC was chugging along. But what I mean to say is that the success of the x86 platform was tied directly to the success of the IBM PC clone market, you know, and how it exploded and everything. And so Intel kept churning out new improvements to that for that market, even if IBM wasn't directly involved in the design. And it all started with the IBM PC in 81.
Yeah, people, I don't think IBM has a huge presence in commercial computing anymore. But back in the 80s, they were really the Cadillac of computer makers. Like if you could buy a PC clone, like this spec was quickly and widely imitated by people who made much less expensive clones. But if you bought the IBM model, you knew you were getting, you know, the best possible version of it, like a great system, yeah, made well, just a reliable system that would be a performance monster for a long time to come.
They're built like tanks. They're like, my original IBM PC, the 5150, sorry, the original model I have is like, it's so solid. It's like, it has a steel case, it has this huge chunky power supply. The keyboard still works like crazy. It's got buckling springs, just like my Model M keyboard clicks. And yeah, it still works. I mean, 40 years later, it's still chugging along. A lot of old computers I have crapped out by now. They had substandard parts, but IBM used all the best parts at the time.
Is there any relationship between the IBM 5150 and Van Halen's 5150?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
What year did your 5150 come out, the album?
I think it was like 84, wasn't it?
Yeah,
83, 84.
So there's your answer. It has no connection to it. But
I feel like another measure of the success of that platform, though, is the other thing that happened in 84 was the Macintosh coming out, and like the ad campaign for that was, right, it was this Big Brother pastiche, but it was setting up the Macintosh as a reaction against the ubiquity of the IBM PC and all of its clones. And that was just, you know, 3 years after this. So that platform had been so successful that by 1984, IBM PC and PC clones were the standard to react against. Yeah. That's kind of remarkable.
The clone explosion was huge and immediate. I think the first clones came out in 82, the Compaq and all that. And then there were more in 83 and 84, and they just kept coming and coming. And then it was just, but there's one thing that's neat about the IBM PC is for the, I don't know, the 30th anniversary of it, I went to my parents' house and sequestered myself in a room. They had a spare room, and I hooked up a 5150 PC and tried to use it for work for like a week. And it was the weird experiment that I wrote about for PC World. It's called "Can You Do Real Work with a 30-year-old IBM PC?" And it's a neat article you could look at.
How did it go?
It was surreal and strange, but it went pretty well. I think my conclusion was, of any of the older computers that I had to actually try to work on, as in like write an actual article on, or, you know, even use the internet on to do email or some kind of thing like that, I would pick that over other machines because of its versatility and its reliability and the nice keyboard, things like that. So,
all right,
it was neat.
So yeah, the IBM PC, not really meant for gaming necessarily, but essential to the evolution of video games. And, you know, speaking of clones, If we turn our attention to the Japanese side of things, you have NEC's PC8801, which was not a clone of IBM's PC, but it was powered by an NEC Mu series chip, which was an 8080 clone, which is, you know, kind of what the 8086 was derived from. So, you know, this was kind of the Japanese take on the personal computer standard. I don't know that NEC's model was necessarily cloned, but it was very widespread. That and the 16-bit follow-up, the 9801, they were just huge and made massive inroads into the Japanese market. It's kind of important to note that back in the early 80s, especially, the computer market, when you looked internationally, it was very, you had kind of this Galapagos effect, where every country, every region, every territory sort of gravitated toward its own local systems for its own purposes, you know, its own individual reasons. You know, things like Commodore 64 and the ZX Spectrum were huge in Europe and in England. You had Commodore 64 was huge in the US, but also the IBM PC and the Apple II. And then in Japan, you had basically the Sharp series, X1, and NEC's PC8801. And these were more successful in Japan, understandably, because they had very wide column graphical support, which was essential to being able to type out text in Japanese kanji, like the very dense pictographic ideograms that they use for, you know, most written content. You can write in the phonetic alphabets in Japanese, but it's very inelegant and difficult to read. It's just kind of an eyesore and a headache. So having these systems that had, you know, like they used to measure computer resolution by text columns, and Japanese resolutions were just much denser than the standard American resolutions. I think, you know, IBM PC introduced what, EGA? CGA? What did it start with?
CGA and MDA.
Yeah, CGA was like monochrome. Garbage. It was almost like, it was terrible. Very low resolution, yeah. No color support. The Japanese systems,
well, some color support.
Some, but nothing. Yeah, that's no color support.
Yeah.
It didn't get decent until VGA in the mid 80s. But Japanese PCs, because they had to support kanji text, text in kanji, they had high resolution graphics right from the outset, from the early 80s. And so these very quickly were snapped up to become gaming machines. Like, people saw the potential, like, wow, you have so much resolution there, and it might just be, you know, eight colors, but at that degree of resolution, you can do all kinds of dithering and interlacing effects and create the illusion of a greater color depth for your computers. So they became very popular for video games, adventure games, especially at the time it started to really take off in Japan, role-playing games, like these games that were kind of slow-paced, based around static imagery that the PC8801 was really, really well suited to. And so it was really kind of, I would consider the PC8801 the basis of Japanese personal computers, PC gaming. And that's something you don't really hear about a lot these days. Like, mm-hmm. you look and at Japan and you don't see a whole lot of games being developed for PC. The ones that are mostly developed for PC now are kind of in the vein of soft porn adventure, except a lot racier and or pornographic. But so many games that we know from hard consoles, porn. Yes, hard porn. So many games that we know from consoles got their start on PC8801. Things like, you know, Hydlide or all the Falcom games, that sort of thing. That's where they got their start. Even Dragon Quest kind of derives from the Portopia Serial Murder case, which was a PC8801 game, if I'm not mistaken. And Dragon Quest is like the next iteration of that, turning it into an RPG. So really just a massively important platform that is not very well known here in the US, just because, you know, foreign computers that require the ability to navigate a text parser in another language, kind of rough to work with if you don't speak that language. But there's just all kinds of stuff that is really not that well documented, especially in the West, and is really kind of, to me, represents a huge frontier of video game archivism and exploration. It's, you know, stuff that needs to
by
be
the way,
covered much more deeply.
You know, I used to have these huge collections of magazines from the early 80s, computer magazines from the 70s and 80s. And if you read through them, the early 80s, whenever NEC or somebody or Sharp or something tried to sell a computer here, the magazines would be like, have one little column and one paragraph and a picture of it. And like, this is another weird Japanese computer, you know, it doesn't run anything you want or, you know, and it's just, they sort of dismiss it. And it wasn't, they had so much trouble getting an inroads in the market here for some reason, probably just because of the, you know, we had this rah-rah American Apple IBM, you know, stuff going on in the industry in America.
Yeah, but even more than that, it was just, you know, the logistics of import tariffs and, you know, the shipping issues. It was a much bigger world back then. The world is much smaller now. Like, I can order something on eBay from Japan, and because they won't ship by postal service anymore from Japan to the US. So everything is either like sea freight, which takes 3 months, or it's DHL. So you place an order for something, and 2 days later, DHL is right there at your doorstep. Like, here you go. Here's the thing you bought, which just like that was inconceivable 40 years ago. So yeah like there were a lot of logistical pricing distribution issues with taking computers into their markets. And, you know, that was also the case for consoles. Like, that's why the Family Computer, the Famicom, was huge in Japan, and the Atari was huge here. And it took a long time for Nintendo to kind of break through that. And, you know, there were a lot of changes that happened politically and with shipping and distribution and economics and so on and so forth that we do not have time to get into. But that was a big important evolution in the in business and international markets in the 80s.
Yeah. Like, I remember my first contact with that line of, like, knowledge of that line of computers was, like, it's where, you know, Japan's indie game scene ended up too for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so, like, when I was into, like, shareware and stuff on Macintosh over here in the 90s, and I was also getting into anime, I was like, oh, there's all these cool, like, indie anime style games, but they're all on the Japanese PC-88 lines. And I'm like, well, there's no way I can get my hands on those.
By the way, do you know what the very first IBM PC game was? I happen to know.
Okay, tell us.
It was a port of the Colossal Cave Adventure, published by Microsoft. It was called Microsoft Adventure 1981. And so it was a text adventure game, you know, and you explore a cave.
Oh, yeah. I think that was highlighted in an episode of Halt and Catch Fire, where everyone at the studio got really addicted to that game.
That's neat. Yeah. I still haven't actually seen that show, even though.
I think you'd enjoy it. Even though you'd be pulling your hair out over some minor inconsistencies and inaccuracies, but it is a pretty well-researched love letter to that era of computing.
They asked me twice for stuff for that show. Like,
you should have been a consultant on that show.
Yeah, but then they pull it back and like, whoops. Like, I was trying to find a bunch of Commodore monitors for them once. And I was getting, and then like some other like PC stuff for them, and then they'd be like, nope, we don't need any more, sorry. And so I don't watch that show.
Ah, okay. Well, I don't have a grudge, so I enjoyed it. Anyway, one last thing to discuss for 1981... Ben, this is all you. The TI-99 foray. Actually, Benj and Chris, you can also chime in.
So the TI instruments. We actually did a whole episode on this. So, you know, that info is all out there. But this is the one. This is one I had when I was a kid. It was a neat little computer. So it was one of those in this hybrid space that kind of existed back then between personal computers and gaming systems. So it had... It was an all-in-one unit with a keyboard, and, like, you know, you could program BASIC on this thing, but it also had a cartridge slot, and it had cartridge games like an Atari. And so it had, like, clones of all the usual stuff. There was a Pac-Man clone called Munchman. There was a Space Invaders clone called TI Invaders, I think. But it also had some fun other things that were kind of its own thing. It had that Tombstone City thing that we briefly mentioned before, which is kind of like, if you take Pac-Man, but you own the whole maze, and then you zoom out and the monsters are coming in from outside the maze and you're trying to shoot at them, and you turn them into, they turn into obstacles when they die, sort of like Centipede. And then it had things like Alpiner, which is this thing with big graphics of you being a mountain climber climbing up the mountain, and there's like huge bears that swat at you. And a lot of things that you just didn't see on too many other platforms ended up on there. It was a weird little system. It's like system-wise, it was, let's see, the introductory price was $500 in 1981, so it was cheaper than some of the other home PCs, and I think actually they ended up getting into a price war with Commodore later, which destroyed the company. Yeah.
And the entire industry.
Yay! Yeah.
Well, guess what? Remember when I was telling you about researching, the Atari 8-bit computers? Like, that price war tanked Atari. It tanked the video game industry because it drove down the price of computers so low that everybody was saying, let's buy a computer instead of a game console. So they all started buying those, and there was no profit in it because it's just insane. So it's all Commodore's fault. I digress.
Bastards.
Yep. What was I saying? It also had 16K of RAM. It was technically a 16-bit computer. It had a 16-bit processor, but it was a little bit hobbled because, like, the memory bus to most of its memory was actually 8-bit. So it had some weird design decisions that kind of held it back. And then another weird thing about it is it has all kinds of weird peripherals you can get for it. One I actually had, so you could get a cassette tape deck expansion, and you could save out your programs and data to audio cassette and read them back. Kind of using a cassette as if it were a reel-to-reel hard drive. There was like a voice expansion box, like a speech synthesizer.
Speech synthesizer.
Crazy for the time. All kinds of weird stuff you could get for it.
Yeah, and I know I've mentioned this before, but because I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, where TI had one of its manufacturing plants, those things were everywhere when I was growing up. So definitely a very pervasive system, just hard to get away from. But, you know, pretty capable.
Yeah, I recommend listening to that episode we did about TI that Ben mentioned. It was really cool.
Yeah, that was, gosh, was that a couple years ago now? I don't even know.
We were so awesome.
It's like 4 years ago, 3 years ago.
Yes, 3 years ago was several decades at this point. So anyway, yes, that is 1971 and 1981. And we went a full hour and a half on this, even though I swear to God we would not. So the only thing we can do now is get back together sometime soon and give an hour and a half to 1991. And this time Chris will be allowed to talk.
Woo.
Chris will have things to talk about. Also, Bob Fetterdang will talk about all my favorite things in 2001 since he stole that from us.
You should email him, send him a sternly worded message and say, put me on your show.
Retronauts incursion.
That's right. Anyway, yeah. So as always, there was much more to talk about than I expected, even though I tried to trim down what we could actually talk about. Man, podcasts are so weird and confusing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was good talking to you guys. It's been a long time since we've done a Retronauts East, but hopefully it won't be quite so long before the next.
Yeah, it's been like a year almost. I don't know. Other than the time we did something at that the PAX East.
No, there was one we... Oh, you weren't able to join in for that one. That's the problem.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I was. Back in the before times when we could go to people's houses.
Yes. So anyway...
Well, I'm glad we're all still alive.
Yes, that's very good. And hopefully people enjoyed this jolt of memory, of nostalgia for recording approaches back in the day. I don't know what I'm saying. Anyway, clearly I'm out of practice with podcasting. I'm totally losing my train of thought here. But that was it. 1971, 1981. As we move into 2021, we will circle back around and visit 1991, which was a momentous year. But that is it for this episode. And as always, we can do the usual chatter here. For instance, I can say that Retronauts is a podcast you can find on the internet and at the Greenlit Podcast Network. You can help support the show through Patreon if you enjoyed what you just heard, and you should have because it was so good. You can go to patreon.com/retronauts for, I'm trying to remember, I think $3 a month. Yes, you can subscribe to get each episode a week early. For $5 a month, you get bonus content every month. Every other Friday, there is another podcast in addition to the Monday shows, and also weekly columns every Saturday or Sunday by Diamond Fight. And we're always talking about throwing some more stuff in there. Sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. But it's kind of a crapshoot, and it's good stuff for a pretty modest subscription fee, less than the cost of a hamburger, unless it's a very bad burger.
Delicious.
Chris, you've been quiet. Tell us where we can find you so people can get a handle on what you're actually like.
Well, I am the host of several other podcasts here on the Greenlit Podcast Network and elsewhere. You can find links to all those at the-isb.com. That's my old website. Or greenlitpodcast.com will take you to shows like War Rocket Ajax or Apocrypals or Movie Fighters or Snack Situation, the podcast.
I haven't heard of that one.
Where I eat things. It's on the Movie Fighters feed. It's very good. It's a sub podcast.
Got it.
It's clear Chris has a podcast addiction or something.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. And in fact, I did just launch a new one that I do with my wife. It is a backer exclusive podcast at the War Rocket Ajax Patreon. It's called Every Pint Ever. It's my wife and I being extremely married and also reviewing every pint of ice cream that we eat. It's very fun.
Here I was hoping for beer. But...
All right. Yeah. So that was Chris. Ben, where can we find you on the internet?
Me, I am on the Twitters. Kieran, K-I-R-I-N-N, is where you can find my Twitter feed, which I occasionally still use. I'm not on any other podcasts at the moment. I'm just weird like that. It's just this one.
Okay. And finally, Benj.
Hey, guys. This is Benj Edwards. I am not on any other podcasts either, other than this one. And it's been a crazy year, but I'm working at How To Geek right now as a staff writer. And you can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards. You can follow my shenanigans there where I hook up weird Ataris to my tiny CRTs on my desk and things like that. It's fun.
All right.
And I did research this time. It's the first time ever.
Thank you. That was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Patreon.
All right. So that's everyone except me. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and you can check out my YouTube channel, which is called Jeremy Parrish, because that's also my name. It's an amazing, amazing coincidence, but it's very convenient also. So
that's my name too.
I don't know about that one. But anyway, that's it for this episode of Retronauts. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back sometime, hopefully soon, to tell you what was up with 1991. I got to do that before Bob records 2001. So got to get in there, otherwise it's going to be asynchronous and everyone's going to be confused, like, what, we skipped the story, what's the plot here, what's happened with video games, who killed JR?